playing. That's right, Mac. We're playing all Rolling Stones tonight. Rolling Stones special here on Quartz in Session. I'm your rocking attorney, Eric Jackson Lurie. And you know, that last set of music was all Keith Richards on lead vocals, starting off with You've Got the Silver. Request for Charlie and Crafton, Little TNA, going back to the Tattoo You album. And here's a little EJL secret. Desert Island, that is my favorite album of all time. Tattoo You, Rolling Stones, Drawn My Line in the Sand. The Worst, going back to 1993 from Voodoo Lounge. I Want to Hold You Live from the Bridges to Bremen album, Live 1998 Stones Tour. And a couple requests. One for Jack in Wilmington, North Carolina, sending out in memory of his mom. And one for Dr. Michael of Health Horizons in Oakmont. They both wanted to hear Slipping Away from the Steel Wheels album, going back to 1989. And I'll tell you what, that album, man, that was my first time seeing the Stones on tour. It had looked like the Stones were never getting back together, never going to tour, and they came to Three Rivers Stadium. You know, I've seen the Stones. This week's going to be my seventh time, and each time I've seen them, my tickets have gotten progressively worse. I was a kid with no money in high school, and I was way up front. And now I'm way up in nosebleed heaven, but that's all right. That's okay with me. If I'm going to see the Stones live, everything is good in this world. So everyone knows the hit Miss You. It's an iconic Stones tune, but a lot of people have never heard this next version. There was they called it a disco remix, but really it was the full length of the song the way the Stones originally intended it, but it was edited for the album and even more edited for the 45 single. I'm going to play the full length version. It's not on the album. It's on 12-inch DJ singles out and about. You got to get yourself to your record conventions and dig for it if you like it. But there's different lines to this. There's different music to this. And if it's your first time hearing it, you're going to dig it. Going back to 1978, this is Miss You, Rolling Stone Special, WRCT, 88.3 FM. We'll be right back.
we owe them everything, you know. And that's really the bottom line, because, you know, it's the fans that have made the Rolling Stones what they have made it possible for us, for me to be doing what I am now, you know. That's what they've meant to me. Yeah, I mean, everything from being strangled to being made to feel incredibly good, you know. And, talking about personal meetings with fans, you know, I used to do the run from the stage door to the car, you know, and as I say, twice I got strangled on the run and left in the gutter, the car going, the rest of them saying, you know, see, we could pick you up on the way round. The fans, I mean, I've known the fans in just about every conceivable situation, you know, from being half murdered to being sort of rescued. Bless their hearts.
From day one, it was always amazing that somebody came to see me play anyway. I'm not talking about the others, just me. I don't know what to say. I've never sort of... It's not something I sit and analyse, really. I never quite understood why they turned up in the first place. So I always only ever thought the Rolling Stones would be going for about 3 years. Bands didn't go on, you know. I play with them because I like the people in the band. If you're playing for 2 hours, you know, and there's sort of set numbers, any band plays, you know, that's part of the fun, is to see people enjoying themselves. And one of the ways is to play, say, songs that you just, you know, you haven't played for years, but they're popular, and so you just put them in again.
First of all, the Rolling Stones fans, to me, have been a very special, huge bunch of people. Because the acceptance to me joining was something which was really pleasing to me, because I was hit between the eyes with not only being accepted really well, but the reaction seemed to be a very natural one from them. It wasn't like... oh, so this is the new guy, right? I felt at home straight away. Ever since the first tour, which I did with the Stones in 75, and the thing that struck me with the fans is the fact that I could look into an audience, especially in daylight shows where you can see further than the first 20 rows, and you could see the original followers of the Stones, that generation, and a few feet shorter than them were their kids holding their hands, and below them were their kids' kids. So they had three generations that stood out to me as very touching.
There was a show in Lowestoft in 1964 that we played at the Grand Hotel, and halfway through the set, the girls sort of jumped on the stage and started to sort of tear our clothes, you know, and all that. And I had one arm of a shirt ripped right off and waistcoat torn apart, all the buttons and everything, and the collar sort of half gone. And they took the ring from my finger. I had a ring, which I'd had about 10 years, you know, since I was a real kid. It was like a real prized possession because we had no money in those days. And they took that. And I felt a bit cut up about that afterwards, you know, because I'd had that ring a long time. And about a week later, when I was back in town, I received a package in the mail. And when I opened it, this little package, there was the ring apologising and saying, "We hope we didn't upset you too much, but we're not sending you the shirt sleeve back." I thought that was really great. Yeah, well, that's really the lifeblood of the band, I think. It's the thing that always amazes you, but it always happens. Every tour in any country, you always see new fans down the front. Young ones, and they seem to have a good time. I think they come for curiosity, or because their mums maybe told them or something, or their older brothers. And there they are in the front, and it's great to see them bopping and having a good time. And we really like dig all those young fans in the front. And so the age level of the audience just gets wider and wider. It's like a torch beam.
Some people that over the years have consistently written to you that you feel... you've written back and sent them things, and you do have a relationship with them, which goes back to when you were just, say, 20 years old. So this is kind of touching, really, in a way that that can continue for that long, you know, from all over the world, really. And I find that pretty amazing to last that long. It's very nice that you have a growing audience. I think that a changing audience, I mean, some people, they're not going to last forever. They're going to buy one or two records, be interested in you for a little while, and move on to something else. People that get married, settle down, and are no longer interested in music, maybe. And it's nice that this band has been able to acquire new fans, or whatever you want to call people that like them, as they go along. And it's nice that that sort of transcends generations, you know. That some people that like us are older than me, and some people younger than my daughter.
A little interview with Mick, Keith, Woody, Charlie, and Bill, coming from a fan club record issued in 1981. You do the math, a long time ago, talking about some of their fans being older, some fans being younger. Pretty cool. Well, we're going to keep it going tonight. We're going to keep it going to 11. We got a lot of requests still to get to. What a terrific night. Thank you for all the great phone calls. We're going to sign off the show now, but we'll keep it going for another half hour. Want to thank you so much for tuning in tonight. I'm your rocking attorney, Eric Jackson Lurie. If you missed any part of tonight's show, you can catch it in half an hour coming at you out of the West Coast at 1033WWRO.com. You can hear a replay of tonight's show Sunday night at 11 right here on WRCT. And next Thursday at 8, we'll be back together again live. Tell your friends, tell your family, turn up that stereo, turn up that radio. Let's get back together next Thursday night at 8. I want to remind you to take care of each other, be kind to each other, and be proud to be American. We're going to close off tonight's show with the latest live recording from the Stones. Came out late in 23 with tracks from the new album. This is live from the Racket in New York City. I'm your rocking attorney saying, good night, Pittsburgh. Avenue, this town's wearing tatters. Yeah. Go.
Thank you. Hey. It's great to be back.
Hi, it's Tori DeVito.
In every family, small conversations can make a big impact. Like when my dad shared his experiences as an alcoholic.
Your honesty about that part of your life gave me a sense of integrity that I wanted to uphold in my own life.
I wanted you to know from someone who's been in recovery more than 30 years now that hard work is what creates success, not alcohol or other drugs. I said it a lot, and I'm glad you took it to heart.
Talk, they hear you. For more information, visit underagedrinking.samhsa.gov.
Want our kids to grow up safe and healthy, so we show them how, and we tell them with honest conversations that let them know what we expect. That's especially important when it comes to alcohol and other drugs. Kids need to know the dangers and how to avoid them. And when it comes to pain medications, opioids, they need to know that they should never be taken without a prescription and never shared with friends or family. It's dangerous and illegal. So talk with your kids, because when you talk, they hear you.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, the long-fought effort to get legal acknowledgement of the abuses of Iraqi detainees during the Iraq War is coming to a federal court in Virginia with Al-Shamari versus CACI, or CACI. Since the case was first filed in 2008, military contractor CACI has pushed some 20 times to have it dismissed. Time magazine unwittingly told the tale with their recent headline, "Abu Ghraib Military Contractor Trial Set to Start 20 Years After Shocking Images of Abuse." See, that's the thing. People had been reporting the horrific treatment of Iraqi detainees at the Baghdad area prison and elsewhere, but it was only when those photos were released, photos the Defense Department tried hard to suppress, that it was so undeniable it had to be acknowledged. We got a reading on the case last year from Bahir Azmi, legal director at the Center for Constitutional Rights. Also on the show, historians tell us that the Cold War is over, but the framing persists in news media that love a simple good guy versus bad guy story, even as who the good and the bad guys are shifts over time. Telling history through actual human beings makes it harder to come up with slam dunk answers, but can raise questions that are ultimately more useful for those seeking a peaceful planet. A new book provides a sort of case study on that. It's about Ted Hall, who, as a young man, shared nuclear secrets from Los Alamos with the then Soviet Union. Veteran investigative journalist Dave Lindorf has reported for numerous outlets. He's author of Marketplace Medicine and This Can't Be Happening, among other books. We talked with him about his latest, Spy for No Country, the story of Ted Hall, the teenage atomic spy who may have saved the world, which is out now from Prometheus Books. That's coming up this week on Counterspin. The New York Times ran a poignant obituary last year for Ian Fishback, a former Army major who became an anti-torture whistleblower. Fishback spoke up about prisoner abuse in 2004, and when his concerns were ignored in the military, he brought them to the wider world, in the wake of revelations about abuses against Iraqi men at the Baghdad area prison Abu Ghraib. The obituary suggests compassion for Fishback and for the victims of U.S. military actions that he tried so hard to spotlight. But when a judge said that one case calling the perpetrators to account would go forward, the Times didn't report on it. Though that month they did feature a piece about why George W. Bush, quote, doesn't second-guess himself on Iraq, close quote. And that's the spotty story of big media coverage of the documented horrific abuses at Abu Ghraib and elsewhere carried out by U.S. military and hired contractors. Earnest concern sometimes, but not the sort of sustained, systemic investigation that would prevent their recurrence. The civil trial against U.S. defense contractor CACI, or CACI, began this week. It's one of the last vestiges of efforts to call major actors to account for what happened at Abu Ghraib. And media are covering it. CNN notes that two decades after revelations of torture, the proceeding is the first time Abu Ghraib survivors are able to bring their story to a U.S. jury. CACI's lawyers, unsurprisingly, lay all of the fault on what one literally called, quote, a handful of bad apples, close quote. There were MPs, said John O'Connor, quote, who were sadistic, who did it on their own and without any encouragement, close quote. We'll see if news media have the appetite to interrogate that dismissal, or if, like high-level Bush White House officials, they will condemn it heartily and then move on. Al-Shamari versus CACI was brought on behalf of three Iraqis by the Center for Constitutional Rights. Counterspin spoke with CCR's legal director, Bahir Azmi, last August.
This is actually the third of three cases we brought on behalf of Iraqi victims of torture by the U.S. government and private military contractors in Iraq and Abu Ghraib. One case was thrown out by the D.C. Federal Court of Appeals, led by Kavanaugh with a dissent from then Judge Garland. A second case on behalf of 71 individuals brought against a translation company, L3 Services, that settled favorably. And this, the third, is brought on behalf of three remaining plaintiffs, three victims of torture at the so-called hard site at Abu Ghraib, where all of the depictions of torture we have seen were revealed. And it's very challenging to sue the U.S. military for torture, but U.S. generals did an investigation of the torture at Abu Ghraib and identified that private military contractors, including CACI, had a preeminent role. CACI sent a number of untrained individuals to serve as interrogators under a very profitable $35 million contract. And as the report and the evidence revealed, in the command vacuum that occurred at Abu Ghraib, that it was khaki interrogators who were telling military police, including people you might recognize if you're old enough, Lindsey England, Ivan Frederick, and Charles Grainer, to, quote, soften up detainees via torture for its later interrogation by khaki. So this piece, accountability against the private military contractor for actions that U.S. service members spent considerable time in a military brig for, and it seeks to close that accountability gap and hold this profit-making enterprise accountable for its clear role in contributing to the torture and abuse of our plaintiffs.
Well, I don't know if it matters to say at this point that prisoners in Abu Ghraib were not criminals. These were not people who were charged and convicted, but maybe that's worth mentioning here.
Correct. And there are clear duties under the laws of war to respect their not engage in war crimes or what is called cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment. And notably, the judge in this case has found sufficient evidence that khaki was a direct conspirator, aided and abetted the actual torture of our clients. So enough evidence that a jury could find them liable. And that's what we're hoping will be the next step in front of a United States jury.
Well, khaki says, as I understand it, that since the United States would have immunity in this case, well, then we were working for them, so we also have immunity. What do you have to say? I mean, I remember an interview with deeply missed CCR President Michael Ratner explaining in 2004 that this idea that torture isn't torture came in with U.S. Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez, and kind of things went south at that point. But that's khaki's line, that since we're acting as the government, we therefore have immunity against these charges?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. The subtext of this is a really sort of disturbing pattern among all private military contractors, which I think is seeking precisely this. Even though they act for profit, have no sovereign responsibilities, are in no way politically accountable, democratically accountable, they want to assume the same benefit as the government, as if khaki was a sovereign entity rather than a profit-making entity. That seems like a terrifying notion for me. And the subtext is, I think, ultimately from a range of private military contracts, to get the law in the place to fulfill a kind of Eric Princeian vision where private military contractors can go into war spaces and enjoy the same immunity as the United States government. And so far, the courts have plainly resisted that. You're not allowed to assume the immunity of the United States government, if you yourself have broken the law, even as a contractor. And the courts have rejected khaki's argument, building on what John Yoo and Dick Cheney have said, just these are not legal questions, they're political questions. They're out of the jurisdiction of the courts, what we choose to do with prisoners during wartime. But the court flatly rejected that and said they can be accountable for torture, even if they were participating with the military.
All right, then. Well, for many people, Abu Ghraib is a series of horrific photographs, and maybe the government's efforts to suppress them, the media's release of them, and then a kind of collective gasp, you know, shocking the conscience, we heard. But then we got the sense, vaguely speaking, that since we've had our conscience shocked, we've addressed it, and so let's all move on from that difficult time. But if no real deep-going, up-to-the-top accountability happens, aren't we just kind of setting ourselves up for the next, oh my gosh, that's terrible, that's carried out in our name?
Well, you know, I really quite agree, and I've been, you know, as someone who's been heavily involved and early involved in the responses to the human rights crisis created by the Bush administration and the lawlessness there, I draw a connection between the kind of soft authoritarianism of the Bush administration and the sanctioned lawlessness and demand for impunity and subverting U.S. institutions and constraints on executive power to the kind of hard authoritarianism that the Trump administration embraced. I mean, should we really be surprised by the Muslim ban that Trump escalated, given what the Bush administration tried and largely got away with? Should we be surprised with lawyers like John Yoo in the torture context and John Eastman in the insurrection context, trying to sanction or legitimize under law subverting American institutions. I think precisely the problem with not holding high-level officials to account is these abuses get replicated and indeed escalated.
Well, we're going to end on that important note. We've been speaking with Bahar Azmi, legal director at the Center for Constitutional Rights. You can track their work, including on this case, which is not closed, but is going forward at ccrjustice.org. Bahar Azmi, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you very much.
That was CCR legal director Bahar Azmi speaking with us in August 2023. The success of the movie Oppenheimer showed that there is interest in the human beings involved in the Manhattan Project. The choices, beliefs, situational ethics, if you will, of those involved in the World War II program to develop the atomic bomb. Another key figure, likewise reflective of the human complexities involved in creating and deploying this devastating technology, has remained relatively unknown until now. Ted Hall was just 18 years old when he was recruited to Los Alamos, where he became a key scientist behind the bombs known as Little Man and Fat Boy, and eventually a spy, delivering nuclear secrets to the Soviet Union. His story was the subject of the 2022 documentary A Compassionate Spy by acclaimed Hoop Dreams director Steve James. Our guest was a co-producer of that film and is author of a new book, Spy for No Country: The Story of Ted Hall, the Teenage Atomic Spy Who May Have Saved the World, from Prometheus Books. Veteran investigative journalist Dave Lindorf has reported for numerous outlets and is author of Marketplace Medicine and This Can't Be Happening, among other titles. He joins us now by phone. Welcome back to Counterspin, Dave Lindorf.
Thanks for having me on.
Well, we can't presume listeners who knew who Robert Oppenheimer was even before the movie have even heard the name Ted Hall before. So, in bold strokes, what did he do and when or in what context?
Well, Ted Hall is really fascinating because he was so young. He's been overlooked, I think, by historians even of that era of the atomic development of atomic energy. And part of the reason, too, is that he was never prosecuted, even though in 1950, he was one of the first people identified as an atomic spy at Los Alamos, with the final decryption starting to happen of the Soviet spy cables that the precursor to the NSA had been collecting from Soviet consulates. Yet, despite Hoover getting that information in 1950, and interrogating him and his Harvard roommate Currier for 3 hours, the case went nowhere, and the book explains why.
Folks may not remember, or it might be a little confuddled, the Soviet Union was an ally during World War II.
That's a very important point to make that people have to realize as they learn about this guy.
Yeah. So as much as we might want to ascribe motivation, especially after the fact, we can never see inside another person's head. But what is the sense of what Hall thought he was doing? He wasn't, for instance, a communist himself.
No, he was not a communist when he was a spy. He did briefly join the party. He and his wife that he married after the war, they both became party members for a few months because, as they said, it was the only organization they felt that was combating the segregation in the U.S. and that was defending workers' right to organize.
When we say, what did Ted Hall do? What did he do and why do we think he did it?
Well, he was so smart, incredibly brilliant, and it was recognized when he got there. He was assigned to be working on the development of the implosion system for the plutonium bomb, which was a very complicated bomb. The uranium bomb was very simple, but you just had to refine enough U-235, which is a minute portion of uranium ore, in order for it to work. But with plutonium, it was so unstable that it was very hard to work with in large quantities. So he was working on that project. He understood the entire details of the plutonium bomb, and he realized that the Germany was not going to get the bomb. It was being bombed to smithereens in 1944 when he was hired, and that the U.S. was going to come out of the war with a monopoly on the bomb, which he thought would be a catastrophe for the world, I think correctly. So he decided the only thing to do was to give the Soviets the bomb so that there would be two countries with the bomb that would prevent each of them from using it.
Well, I've heard it said that, you know, put simply, Oppenheimer thought he could somehow get nuclear weaponry eliminated or under international control. But as you say, Hall thought that mutually assured destruction would keep this technology from being used. Is that?
Yeah.
Well, I appreciated a review of the film, A Compassionate Spy, in Decider that said, "Is Ted Hall a hero or a traitor? Note to everyone everywhere, you don't need to answer that question." In other words, agreeing with him and his actions isn't necessary. It's really more about the complexity of truth, that questions exist for which there are no satisfying answers. But I think it's difficult for folks to put themselves back in the head of a person making that choice at that time.
Well, you have to know what people were thinking at that time. At that time, for example, there was a dinner hosted by the British scientists who'd been brought over at a late period. I guess they came in early 1944 from England to help speed up the development of the bomb. And there was a dinner that they hosted, and they had invited General Leslie Groves, the head of the whole Manhattan Project. And over dessert, people were starting to say, this happened in the spring of 1944, that they shouldn't really build the bomb because the Germans weren't going to get the bomb. And why were they developing it? And Groves said, well, as you know, the bomb was not really to target Germany. It was to help control the Soviet Union. And that went around the camp because, you know, that Los Alamos had these rules that Oppenheimer insisted on, that there was absolute openness within the walls of the camp, heavily guarded walls of the camp. But outside, there was no discussion about what they were doing. It was all top secret. Nobody knew what was happening inside that fence. What they didn't know was that there were spies within it, and one of them was Ted Hall. He certainly heard the scuttlebutt, you know, that the Russians were the real target. And that was very disturbing to him and to many of the scientists who felt that the Soviets were doing most of the dying and most of the fighting against the Germans at that time, and that they were our ally.
Well, you touched on it, but let me just ask you directly, why wasn't Ted Hall prosecuted? Why wasn't he treated the way that Oppenheimer was?
It's an amazing story. It turns out that Ted's older brother, 11 years older than him, who had taken charge of his early education and encouraged him to go to Harvard when he was 18, and this brother, Ed Hall, actually became the top rocket scientist for the Air Force and he developed the engine for the Atlas, the engine for the Titan, the engine for the Thor missile, and he invented the whole concept of ICBM with solid fuel, the Minuteman. That was his creation and his idea of having hundreds of them in silos as a prevention of nuclear attack on the U.S. was sold by him to the defense secretary at the time in the 50s and then to Eisenhower. So he was so important to the Air Force. I got his FBI file after they first told me there wasn't one, got over 100 pages, that Hoover was hoping that he was going to catch him as a spy, Ed, you know, Hall as a spy, as well as Ted Hall, and the Air Force shut him down. They basically refused to let him question Ed about his own history, just whether he knew anything about his brother, and he denied it. And then by late 1951, Ted was taken off of the security index, and they stopped monitoring his mail and his phones. nobody ever knew that, why he didn't get investigated. And it's just astonishing. Because, Janine, the most important thing about this story, and it's another thing that Americans don't know, as soon as the war ended, the U.S. started in the Manhattan Project, and then later the Atomic Energy Commission, working feverishly to figure out a way to mass-produce atomic bombs. And by 1948, they were producing them at 100 a month. And why were they doing that when they thought that there'd been no spies in the project, and that the Soviet Union would not get an atomic bomb for at least 8 or 10 years after this one? You know, the two bombs were invented by the U.S. and tested on the Japanese. So the reason was they were preparing to attack the Soviet Union. There was even a day they estimated in 1954 that they were calling a day when it would be impossible to attack the Soviet Union preemptively because they'd have the bomb by then and be able to slip one into a harbor in the U.S. As retaliation. And that all fell apart when the Soviets detonated a carbon copy of the bomb that Ted was working on in 1949.
Well, in media, Dave, we know that U.S.-Russia relations are super simplistically presented. It's like Rock'em Sock'em Robots, you know, or King Kong versus Godzilla. And the fact that there are human beings making choices with the information that they have at the time and their thoughts about how what they're doing might be used, it's both difficult to think about and it's easy to obscure. And so some folks now are rattling the nuclear saber, if only rhetorically, again. And what do you think is the value of lifting up Ted Hall's story right now?
Well, first of all, he proved to be right. He did what Oppenheimer wouldn't do by, you know, actually sharing the secrets and making it possible for there to be two countries with the bomb. And the result was that we have not seen an atomic bomb used since Nagasaki. We're on the 79 years and counting since those two bombs were dropped, and none has been used because of, you know, multiple nations having the bomb. You just can't do it. And now whether that'll hold, it's always been pretty precarious, but it's the best that they've come up with is just having mutual assured destruction. It's not a good system, but, you know, it's here. I personally think that it's bluster still, because all the game planning, when they look at what happens if we use an atomic bomb or we reply with an atomic bomb when one is used, it always escalates within, you know, hours or days into a full-scale global strategic nuclear bombing and destruction of the Earth.
Right. Well, let me ask you finally, from a journalism or media perspective, some reviewers of the film in particular have said essentially humanizing Ted Hall at all, and the film talks a lot with his wife, Joan, humanizing him is bias, you know, because he was a traitor, the end. And then other people say, well, we don't really need Wikipedia-style history. We don't need news from nowhere. That it's a disservice to just present sort of big good versus big evil, and that starting from a human perspective helps us locate ourselves within this broad sweep of events that once they're done can seem inevitable. And I don't imagine that you would have been attracted to a story that was kind of cut-paste print. You know, the complexity, was that part of the draw for you?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, think about what he did. At the one hand, he thought that the bomb was a horrible, horrible thing. At the other, he was working feverishly trying to help them get it, because when he was hired, he thought it was important to get it before the Germans did. And then when he found that wasn't the case, he was still working on it because he knew that it was going to be built with him or without him. And yet, that meant he was contributing to when it was finally used, because he wanted to be able to give all the information to the Russians. He knew that there were going to be bombs used if that didn't happen. And I think that's correct, that it must have been torture for him to know that he had helped create what happened in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Yet he felt it was the right thing that he had done. So it was very complicated.
All right, then. Well, we'll leave it there for now. We've been speaking with Dave Lindorf. The new book, Spy for No Country, is out from Prometheus Books. Thank you so much, Dave Lindorf, for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you. And thanks for having me on.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group, based in New York. For more information, you can check out our website, fair.org. The show is engineered by Riley Baer. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.
Listening to WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM over the airwaves in the city of Pittsburgh and online to the world on WRCT.org. The show is called An Experiment with Time, and we're kicking off tonight's experiment with Fela Kuti.